Live from the John L. Santico studio in downtown San Antonio, this is The Source from Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. America has long told itself that free market capitalism and democracy go hand in hand, that free markets create prosperity, innovation, opportunity, and political freedom. But Stanford economist Mordecai Kurtz argues that's wrong. Kurtz warns that because of the extreme wealth now held in the hands of very few, U.S. democracy is under attack, and that we're in a new Gilded Age, Gilded Age 2.0. Tech monopolies are using their riches to purchase media, create favorable tax laws, cut regulations, and amass political power, putting ordinary Americans under their boot. Mordecai Kurtz joins us to discuss his new book, Private Power and Democracy's Decline. And Mordecai Kurtz, welcome to The Source.
Thank you. I'm very pleased to be with you.
Yeah, our phone number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Give us a call. Got a question or comment about democracy and what's happening with free market capitalism. So, Mordecai Kurtz, tell us about, when you say free market capitalism, what are your concerns?
Free market capitalism is, well, number one, let's get some definitions.
Yeah.
Capitalism is a system in which individuals can retain property rights. And there are different kinds of capitalism. There's capitalism which is completely free. There's no government regulations, and there's no interference with private business. But there's capitalism in which there are guardrails, there are limitations, regulations, and areas where there's restrictions. And those restrictions usually are to satisfy democratic needs, social needs, or whatever. So the issue is whether free market capitalism, which is unencumbered, completely unfettered, which is completely free, is compatible with democracy. And what I show in the book is that such a system ultimately results in heavy concentration of power. It creates monopolies. It creates inequalities. It creates division within society. And it gives some power and others takes the powers away from. And that's not compatible with democracy. Now, the question is how it happens, but this is more complicated. Do you want to discuss this in details?
Yeah, well, I mean, how did these tech bros get so rich? You know, billions and billions of dollars. And with all of this money, they are taking over our democracy, it seems.
Well, but the point is that the question that you should ask is, where is the money coming from? First of all, this is the issue. The issue is, it's not only the tech monopolist, because it could be a monopoly in retail, but it is the crucial issue is the use of technology. Technology itself, whether it is used in broadcasting, whether it's used in airlines, whether it's used in retails, it originates in tech. It originates in Silicon Valley, but it proliferates across the country. And when a firm has this power, it has a monopoly because it has, number one, it has a patent. When a company has a proprietary technology, it has a patent. And that patent gives it the company exclusivity. Now, under normal circumstances, we would hope that this would be temporary. We give patents for a short time, and then somebody else will come and compete it out or come out with a better solution. But what I argue is that the way it works is technology breeds technology. You have technologically advantage, then there are many strategies used over time to build pyramids of patents, to build, to acquire your competitor, to buy the technology of your competitors, to intimidate your competitors, and many other strategies outlined in my book. So those strategies enable companies to consolidate an original power that begins with technology and over time becomes more and more powerful, build more and more power over time, and with time, profits are then concentrated in the hands of the few, and the power is concentrated in the few. And this is the mechanism by which the use of technology is transformed into power.
The snowballing effect,
yes.
And just you don't want to get in the way of that snowball as it gets bigger.
Yeah, well, you think that there will be somebody comes up with a better mousetrap, but it doesn't. In reality, it isn't. Microsoft is huge, and nobody is challenging Microsoft. Apple has its own technology, and nobody is challenging Apple. So the point is that over time, their power grows. It doesn't vanish. And technological competition doesn't work. It fails.
And they're using this power, which is coming from this incredible amount of wealth, in order to try to gain control of policy.
Well, number one, they have the ability to influence legislation, which passes laws which are favorable to them, whether it's to banks or whether it's airlines or retail firms. And those laws are usually detrimental to the individual. Take the recent law passed by the beautiful law that was passed by the Trump administration, in which $2 trillion of tax concessions were made to the rich at the expense of individuals' life insurance or health insurance, and welfare. So the individual, the little individual American, pays the price for the accumulation of wealth and power and benefits to those that have the power. And that is exactly how the democracy gets. The problem in the case of democracy in today is more complicated, because it's not only technology that works. It's not only the wealth that affects it, but also there are other causes. Let me just mention two others. One very important fact is the change in the technology of production. In the early part of the 20th century, the dominant technology was the assembly line, the moving assembly line. The moving assembly line has the unique feature that
the Ford assembly line.
Yes, the Ford assembly line that was used by all, but proliferated across American industry, was very beneficial to workers without college education. Ford created it exactly because at the time they were assembling automobiles by using skilled workers on assembly lines which were stationary.
So I've got to take this break. We're going to pick up where you left off, talking about how this created a middle class and without college education, and now that is no longer the case. People can call in as we're talking about capitalism and democracy, extreme wealth happening today. This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We'll be right back.
Support for The Source podcast comes from UT Health San Antonio, South Texas' largest academic research institution, where what is discovered in its labs translates into life-changing patient care. More at uthealthsa.org.
You're listening to The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Mordecai Kurtz is with us. He's a professor of economics. He's emeritus at Stanford University. His newest book is Private Power and Democracy's Decline, How to Make Capitalism Support Democracy. And I had to cut you off. Sorry about that. But we can pick up where you left off, talking about Ford assembly line and workers there.
Right. And I was explaining that the assembly line, the stationary assembly line that was actually developed by Ault in 1903, was building cars by using skilled workers who were very expensive, took a long time to build a car. And Ford understood that in order to make the car cheaper, he has to make the reduce the process into simple, repetitive tasks that can be performed by low-skilled people who are just trained to do just that.
And the standardization of the product, you could have any color Ford that you want as long as it's black, he said.
That's right. Complete standard system and highly repetitive. And that enabled the dramatic decline in the cost of the automobile. It made it into a moving assembly line. It's not stationary assembly line. And for half a century, it actually created a middle class in America because workers were without college education could earn income of middle class income. That was the heart of the American middle class. The computer destroyed all of that. And the robot and the computer destroyed that and created a large class of people who suffered from the development since 1980, which means that between 1980 and 2010, large number of people lost their jobs just because of the technology, in addition to losing their political power, losing their income relative to the others who became very, very wealthy. In addition, a large number of them lost their livelihood. And then the third component that caused the decline of democracy is the culture of so-called completely unfettered freedom. Freedom means you're fully responsible for anything that happens to you. This is the way we interpret it in America. Nobody helps you. Nobody gives any handouts. The government doesn't give any handouts. And based on the idea, this extreme form of nobody gets a handout, America actually canceled the welfare system. This was done in 1990 by President Clinton. It's a symbol. There's nothing wrong with it being freedom, but there's something wrong with the idea that 50 million people would lose their livelihood and there would be nobody to help. Nobody will care about them. When you create a culture which is so extreme, then you take the combination of these three forces, this growing political power of the wealthy, the impoverishment of the class of workers who were thriving in the middle during the middle part of the 20th century, and then being abandoned by intellectuals who said, "Oh, the market will take care of everything. Don't worry, they'll find other jobs that will be equally good jobs." But that never happened. In addition to that, you throw in globalization, which was a policy that has some limitations, but has some advantages. But then it was done without any careful thinking of what the implications are, because it contributed more to more jobs lost. You combine these three forces, you create a force that becomes hostile to democracy. It becomes hostile to the status quo. And this is the basic of Trumpism.
Well, in the Gilded Age, we saw huge tariffs, and here we are again.
Now, yes, it's completely, history repeats itself, particularly for those who don't learn from history.
And I wonder if it's the Gilded Age and the Jazz Age combined that we're in right now.
I'm sorry, I didn't get the question.
Well, if we're in like the Gilded Age, you know, with the robber barons and their mass of growth, and then we had the Jazz Age, where we had this exuberance in the stock market, and then the collapse that led to the Great Depression. If that's where we might be right now.
Yes, you're absolutely right. Yes, but there's an implication in what you're saying that we are heading towards the calamity, you know. Because the next is come the Great Depression. I don't foresee a Great Depression ahead of us. I do see, quite frankly, a period of enormous volatility and and crisis. I don't think that Trumpism and populism will disappear in a whimper. There will be some crisis that will lead to the reform that will come, but there will America had reformed before, and America will be reformed again.
Well, we had huge reforms after the Gilded Age. We had the Progressive Era, and after the Jazz Age, we had the New Deal.
That's right. But you skipped the Big Depression. You know, there will be a New Deal. There will be a New Deal, and I would like to contribute somewhat to it because a couple of chapters in the books make some proposals of where we could go.
Yeah, we'll get to those. We'll get to your reforms. But I am very interested in labor. So we're dealing with something that is unprecedented, you could say, this if AI create, you know, taking away labor, taking away jobs from white collar workers right now. But we're looking at the possibility of AI driven humanoid robots doing a lot more work. We're having robot trucks now on the road, the loss of truck driving jobs. That's a huge job of career for people who don't have a college education. If all those people get displaced, that will be a calamity.
Yes, I think it will be a calamity. And I think that there is an answer to that. The answer is democracy. Democracy of technology. In other words, the choice of technology must be whatever technology you use should be subject to social choice, to society's choice, should be subject to impact of policy. Right now, Silicon Valley would like to go ahead and plow forward. And history shows, if you go back to the last thousand years of history of technology, technological innovations, that most of these innovations displaced workers because it's the cheapest ways to go. But it is very important to understand that there are choice involved. And let me explain with an example, which is my favorite example. Think about a patient coming to an office, is sick and is looking for help. Well, one model is you create a robot in which the person explains to the robot how he feels, what's wrong with him, what's his symptoms. If there are any tests have to be done, then the test could be fed into the robot. And then the robot makes a diagnosis and the robot spews a prescription and sends the person to the pharmacy to get some drug. And in this system, the robot replaced the doctor. The doctor is out of job because the robot replaced the doctor. But then you can create another robot. And the robot you create helps the nurse practitioner. The nurse practitioner now gets a robot that helps her make a diagnosis. It works very, very fast. And therefore, the nurse practitioners can see more patients every day. And the nurse practitioner is now able to do things that the doctor is doing today. And the doctor then can devote his time to see more patients and deal with more difficult cases. In the second design, the robot causes an increase in the productivity of the nurse. It causes an increase in the productivity of the doctor. More people get medical care. Medical care is cheaper, and everybody is better off. Now, the only difference is the first robot might be more profitable. The second robot might be more socially desirable. So here you have a choice between profitability on one side and social desirability on the other side. And that is the choice that we must face. We must use democratic methods of imposing our will so that the society will have something to say about the choice of technology. If that will be the case, then there will be no calamity ahead of us. But if we're leaving it to Silicon Valley to do whatever they want, with no guardrails, with no indication of how to go forward, there will be a calamity.
Well, will the free market make those decisions? Or will people?
No, the free market will not make that decision.
I mean, I should be able to decide if I want to go to the robot or if I want to go to the nurse practitioner with a robot.
Well, but the point is that the system will result. If you go to the next practitioner, the next practitioner may decide that you will see the doctor because your case is more difficult. So the nurse practitioner can make the judgment that your case requires the doctor. Then you will go to see the doctor. You will see the doctor if necessary. It's not that you will not see the doctor if not necessary. The point is that the nurse practitioner can now handle cases that are handleable in easy cases, where the diagnosis is straightforward and there's no need for. In other words, the nurse practitioner is being upskilled. She's being upskilled, and this system that I'm talking about is a system in which robots are upskilling people. People who do not have college education can perform jobs of people as if they had college education, almost, not entirely. I mean, you can't replicate completely. I'm not trying to replicate completely the PhD, but I'm trying to replicate somebody on the master's level, say, so that if you upskill a lot of people, you increase social productivity and everybody's better off.
Isn't it astonishing that this thought experiment that you present is not that outside of reality these days, that technology is moving at a pace where I can actually...
I know. This is the point. This is why we're talking. This is why listeners have to understand that they must contribute to that. They must be active democratically today. They must abandon all kinds of idle thoughts about anything else except support democratic institutions so that we can function as a social society, as a society together, act together in our benefits.
And we should have these conversations now before these things are already being rolled out.
We are. We are talking today.
Sure, but this is not a widely held conversation. I mean, I really want to raise awareness from our listeners that this things are happening. They're happening quick. The future is now. But and we're having this accumulation of wealth in the hands of a few now. They're doing all sorts of things that directly impact our lives and our attention, which is really what they're after. And we need to be involved. We need to be active.
Yes, I think that's exactly what I'm leading to.
Yeah. All right. We're going to take another break here. You can call in. And we have Isai. We'll get you on the air when we come back. The number is 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Talking about the book Private Power and Democracy's Decline, How to Make Capitalism Support Democracy. We're going to dig into things like a social media, Citizens United, whether or not corporations have free speech, and how that has changed us. How these billionaires and maybe soon to be trillionaires are getting involved in our politics and our ability to consume news that has not been manufactured. We're going to continue our conversation with Mordecai Kurtz when we come back from the break. Source continues right after this.
Support for this podcast of The Source comes from Texas Mutual Insurance Company, a workers' compensation provider committed to rewarding policyholders who keep their workers safe and losses low. More at texasmutual.com/TXM Advantage. Texas Mutual. Texans get it.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Private Power and Democracy's Decline, How to Make Capitalism Support Democracy. It is the new book by Mordecai Kurtz. He's arguing that the extreme wealth held in the hands of the very few is a threat to our democracy. Extreme wealth, inequality, technological monopolies, they parallel the late 19th century Gilded Age. And we're finding more about that. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255. Let's go to Isai, and you're on the air.
Hi. So I just had a question regarding the K-shaped economy and how this may impact the further degradation of our state of affairs, given the capitalist insights that you guys have brought up during this discussion.
All right, Isai, thank you for that. K-shaped economy, meaning that we basically have two branches of the economy. One is soaring higher and higher, and the other one is heading towards a dirt nap. Mordecai, Kurtz, what's your take?
I'm sorry, I could not hear the question.
So his concern was about the K-shaped economy. What does that mean but also for us in the United States, but also globally?
Well, this is exactly what we're talking about. The K-shaped development is simply a description of what I'm talking about. That on one side, you've got a small number of people, a tiny little people who are getting extremely wealthy, some people getting well off, and a large number that is hardly keeping pace. Between 1980 and 2015, workers without college education had virtually no increase in standard of living for almost 50 years. So this is what we're talking about. This is the crisis. And the reform that I'm talking about is the reform that I believe is coming.
Well, right now, we're seeing things like, the Ellison family taking control of Paramount with Skydance, and we're seeing basically the destruction of CBS News, normally, had been called the Tiffany Network. It was the gold standard for journalism, broadcast journalism, and now no more. They are using their extreme wealth, and next on their list is CNN, that they're to control the information flow. It seems like these billionaires understand that the democracy, they're afraid of democracy.
I think that would be the case. That is true. In fact, they don't believe in democracy. In fact, I have a whole chapter in the book about the culture of wealth. And during the first Gilded Age, they truly believe in the superiority of the rich. They at that time, they basically believed that monopolies is the natural thing to go because they applied very strange theories of evolution to business and saw themselves as the superhumans who are chosen to be the leaders. Rockefeller calls that the laws of God. Although I must say one thing is useful to keep in mind, that during the first Gilded Age, they at least had one aspect that was positive, and that is they believed that they were custodians of wealth for society. And because of that, they felt obligated to leave behind legacies, giving it back.
Like this Carnegie.
That's right. This is the source of the Ford Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, the Guggenheim Museum, the Frick Collection, and universities and things of this sort. They were very much in favor of distributing that wealth later in life, because they saw themselves, although they felt superior, they also felt that they were also, they had an obligation. This obligation is lost today. Somehow very, very few of them today. Musk, I have not seen any act of Musk that I would regard as a positive contribution to society or any of those. There were some examples of Zuckerberg supporting some medical support in San Francisco and a few others, but very few. And indeed, the same kind of superiority you see today among tech leaders who see themselves, if you look at Peter Thiel, Peter Thiel doesn't believe in democracy. He believes in monopoly. Competition is for the losers, he writes in Wall Street Journal. And if you look at the manifesto that they wrote in Silicon Valley, manifesto of the Optimist Manifesto, look it up. You'll find a very nice way of understanding how they feel superior, that the future is the superiority of the technologists over the rest of us.
You have some choice words for Elon Musk in your book. You refer to him, I think, as a gross example of what is happening. He is on the verge of becoming the world's first trillionaire. He has said that his goal is to become to have $10 trillion. First of all, can you actually earn that much money, or are you just taking everyone else's money?
You're doing both. You're doing both. As a monopolist, you're taking from others. As an innovator, you're inventing something more. So I don't think that we should take it away, took away their contribution. They do make a contribution in terms of innovations, but the compensation they are getting are way out of proportion to what's necessary. You have to understand, the United States, in 1942, President Roosevelt, in his letter to the Congress, suggested that we should set an upper limit of $25,000 for any individual in America. And income tax, marginal income tax, should be 100% above $25,000. $25,000 at that time is about $450,000 today. The Congress didn't give it to him, but the Congress gave him 92% marginal tax above $200,000. And for half a century, the marginal income tax was somewhere between 78% and 92%. And we survived, and we thrived, and we innovated, and we made enormous progress for half a century, so that we can do much, much better in terms of distribution of that wealth. Musk himself cannot make that wealth without the education of Stanford technicians or Harvard technicians working for him, other people working, engineers, scientists working for him, enjoying the environment of the United States that made it possible, the all of the legal structure that make it possible for him to function. And all of that, we pay for it. Therefore, we should be compensated for it. And therefore, the income tax that he should pay and a fraction of that wealth that he makes should go to the public, should be much higher than it is today. So he can make that wealth because he's not taxed very heavily. And one of the main points of my reform is raising taxes on the wealthy.
Raising them quite a bit.
Quite a bit.
What is it, 65% for?
65 marginal tax, maximum tax. Yes, highest rate than 65% and corporate tax 45%.
And a minimum 15% tax?
Yes, for an income above $400,000.
When you hear people like Jeff Bezos saying, if you tax me, it's not going to raise their salaries for any school teachers.
That's not true. It's simply not true. If you tax him, there will be more money for school teachers.
And that's what we should be shooting for. I mean, your view is that we have to, inequality is the problem.
Okay, we're talking about reform. The two principles I'm advocating are two principles for policy. Principle number one is restrain their power, restrain market power they have. They restrain the monopoly power of firms in America. Number two, a more equitable distribution of the gains from technology. These are two principles. Now, each one has many, many items how to do that.
So, like, robots should pay taxes.
I'm sorry?
So, robots should pay taxes.
Yes. Robots should pay taxes because they make profits. If robots make profits, they should pay taxes.
Well, we just got to get there. All right, we got to take one more break here. It's a one-minute break, and we'll be right back. Continue our conversation about private power, democracy's decline. I want to talk to you about social media because you got some interesting things to say about that. Mordecai Kurtz will remain with us. You can call in 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. Source continues after this quick break.
Support for TPR comes from UT San Antonio, offering degree programs and research focused on workforce development, student success, and health innovation across Texas. UTSA.edu. UT San Antonio, the University of Ambition.
This is The Source on Texas Public Radio. We're having a conversation with Stanford economist Mordecai Kurtz. His new book is Private Power and Democracy's Decline, How to Make Capitalism Support Democracy, because what's happening right now is just the opposite. You can call in with your questions and comments, 833-877-8255, 833-TPR-TALK. So when it comes to social media or the great distraction machine, you're saying that Section 230 of the Telecommunications Act of 1996 got it wrong, and we need to fix that. And how would that fix that?
Well, I'm looking at it from the point of view of democracy. What does Section 230 does to democracy? Democracy needs citizens who are educated, who are informed, who understand a situation because they have to vote on it. And democracy becomes more legitimate. The legitimacy of democracy increases as more people are better informed, understand better the situation. Social media have become a huge machinery for the creation of falsehoods, all kinds of information which is distorted, and all kinds of the usual criticism that I don't need to repeat. The fact is that we want channels of communication to contain only truthful information. We want them to be educational. We want them to be sources of information rather than sources of bigotry or sources of hate or sources of division. And therefore, what we want to make sure is that anything which is put in the public domain should be truthful. It should be, and therefore I've evolved on this question. My original thinking at some point, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, was that we should abolish social media altogether and make them into public utilities. People are entirely entitled to communicate and talk to themselves, to their friends. And if they pay $15 a month, they can then talk to anybody they want in among their friends. And then the social media should be prohibited from getting any information at all from them. So they should just be like a telephone, like people were conversing on a telephone. They're entitled to do that if they want to do that. But I've backed off from that position. I really feel that I have no objection now to the social media as they are, except for one thing, one crucial issue, and that is that everything that puts on social media should be truthful. And therefore, what I'm saying is that Section 230 should be revised and states that only truthful information is being protected. So that if you say something in a public medium, which is offensive to somebody, and that somebody feels that he wants to sue you. If it was untrue, then the suit will stand. There will be no protection. But if it was truthful, then this is enough of a protection. If it's truthful, then you can say whatever you want. But if it's falsehood, then it's not protected. That is the position that I hold today.
Let's go to a caller. We have Michael on the line. Michael, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Thank you. And then, David, I think you started touching upon this. I wanted to go back to it just for a second. I grew up under the impression and education of C. Wright Mills and the power elite theory, whereas 1% of the population controls 90% of the wealth, and the military-industrial complex is in cahoots to negate democracy and increase profit. That's kind of a simple summary. Are we seeing now the transfer of who is that 1%, 3%? Is that what's happening? Who are the people that control the wealth? And isn't advertising very similar to social media and the influx and rise of advertising within the last 100 years could be equivalent to social media and the use of social media today?
All right, Michael, thank you for that. So let's focus on the transfer of power question. Has there been a transfer of power?
In my opinion, yes. The transfer of power is reflected in the fact that they are able to pass any legislation they want. They have been able to pass legislation which are very favorable to the very few. I gave the example earlier of the tax law, the beautiful tax law, the Trump tax, beautiful tax law, that was a purely redistributive tax in favor of the wealthy, the reduction was financed by elimination of medical insurance for many, many common Americans. It's an example. Citizens United gives a decision by the Supreme Court that gives the power to corporations to spend as much as they want on the election night. It's true that when it comes to the democratic process, they can never guarantee to get their way, because sometimes people will not vote as they wish. But their ability to influence representatives is now enormous. Just go to Washington and see the number of lobbyists that Google has. Look at the number of lobbyists that Apple has. I mean, each one of these companies have enormous number of lobbyists operating every day, 24 hours a day. How many lobbyists does your listeners have in Washington?
It's supposed to be our representatives. Let me go to another caller. Let's go to Randall. And Randall, you're on the air.
Yeah, regarding Section 230 and all of that, you know, when you just look back at the history of this nation, we always, especially the recent history, we always talk about rights. We never talk about the responsibilities that should go with those rights. One side constantly preaches individual responsibility. You know, if you didn't want to get pregnant, you shouldn't have had sex. If you didn't want to get caught by ICE, you shouldn't have crossed the border. But then when it comes to government responsibility, political responsibility, corporate responsibility, firearms responsibility, then we throw up our hands and say, but rights, but freedom of speech, but Second Amendment. But, you know, if you're going to have a right to something, if you're going to enjoy that, I think there should be a certain level of responsibility attached to that. The right. Only time I think we've ever gotten that right is in our libel and slander law.
Okay, Randall, thank you for that. And Mordecai, did you hear that? Could you answer that?
I agree with the caller that the responsibility is to tell the truth. My responsibility is tell the truth. Never lie. Don't spew out fanciful thoughts. or conspiracy theories that don't have no foundations. If you speak the truth, that's your responsibility. And equally so on the other side. The government will protect you only when you're speaking the truth. So social media will only contain truthful information.
You say we've been brainwashed to think that regulations are bad and that we need to recognize that regulations are a good thing.
Yes. I have spent a good part of the book explaining why regulations are good. The way to think about regulations is think about it this way. You go to a store and you want to buy something, and the thing that you want to buy is something which is in a box, and the shopkeeper just give you the box, but there's nothing on the box as anything. You don't know what's in the box. Now notice, he knows what's in the box, so there's asymmetry between the buyer and the seller. If there's asymmetry between the buyer and the seller, then the seller can exploit the buyer. That's what happened in 1907, up until 1907. Until 1907, you could buy meat in pack in a can, and it said nothing on the can. The Food and Drug Administration came to be and created the regulation saying you must tell the truth of what's inside of the can, and if you lie, you go to jail. So then from then on, the meat that came inside of the can was guaranteed to be good. So you could buy something when the buyer and the seller have the same information, and the regulation was simply forced fairness in the market. The regulations are guaranteed to get fairness in the market to protect the buyers and the sellers alike so they can conduct their business in good fashion.
So we're almost out of time here, but really, really quickly, I've got about less than a minute. Do you think people are waking up to what you're talking about?
Yeah, but the reason that you're inviting me indicates that people are waking up.
Hopefully it's not too late.
No, I don't think it's too late. I think the great reforms are yet to come. America before, and it will do it again.
All right. Mordecai Kurtz, thank you so much. Private Power and Democracy's Decline, How to Make Capitalism Support Democracy. Great conversation. That's The Source on Texas Public Radio. I'm David Martin Davies. Thanks for listening.
This has been The Source on Texas Public Radio. The Source is hosted by David Martin Davies. Tim Gutierrez is the show's producer. Additional production support from Steve Short, Ruben Garcia, Yvette Benavides, and Dan Katz, Vice President of News. The Source is made possible with support from the Gladys and Ralph Lazarus Foundation.